Okay. Talk, Joe.
1, 2, 3, 4. I'm talking right now.
Okay.
K-I-D-E, Brad. Hoopa.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay. All right. So in 3? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
And good morning. This is KIDE Hoopa. We're continuing on with our Tribal Campaign 2016. In our studio right now, we have the incumbent from Mesquite Field seat on the Hoopa Valley Tribal Council, Bradley Marshall. Welcome to Studio 91.
Good morning, Joe. How are you doing today?
We're doing okay. It's been a whirlwind week for us here. We're doing one thing and now another.
I must apologize for missing the voters
thing. Legal Women Voters?
The other day, I was in a meeting with an agency out town talking about child advocacy and trying to get more support in here. The meeting actually went a lot longer than I thought it was going to go, so I got stuck out there.
Okay, what we've done, your opponent was there, and so by the rules of Legal Women Voters, they can't seat one person. They have to have both. So what we did is offer her an opportunity, and we've been trying to make contact with her, so if she can't make it today, we'll have to do it on Monday. That's the absolutely last day. So we're supposed to have 7 days to request equal time, so we'll do the best we can.
Well, thank you.
All we can do is put it on the table.
Thank you.
Okay. So with that, we have Bradley Marshall, who is seeking re-election for the seat on the Tribal Council. So why don't I take a couple minutes here and talk about why you're running again and what you hope to achieve. Then we'll get into some questions that were asked at the League of Women Voters campaign.
Okay. I did send out a letter to all of the registered voters, and I also put it in the newspaper a few months back, which kind of went over all the different things that I have been working on in the course of the year. There's been a myriad more, but I really focused in on 8 areas. The 8 areas I focus in on were based on the original campaign letter I had sent out, and looking back at that and doing what I said I was going to be doing, which is working into some specific areas. But as part of Tribal Council, you get spread over a multitude, as you know, over the years, watching all of the ins and outs of the tribe that we do. With that said, the reason I'm running again is because there's some things that I still want to see completed. We have the rehab center that is now started. We have dialogue going on with a number of tribes trying to pull in funding from the federal government. What I'm looking at as the projection on that is about $25 million to construct, but I'm also looking at ongoing funding and trying to figure out how to get that into a separate compact. It has to be done that way so that the compacts that all of us have with the federal government for our medical facilities will not be touched. In addition, there's a number of hurdles that we have to cross for location. It has to be within the areas of a full-fledged medical facility, which puts it out of the Hoopa area specifically, but it can go towards like Eureka or Reading, wherever there's a full-time medical, 24-hour, and that's within the mandates of the guidelines that IHS has sent out for what they expect from a rehab center. So that one's been underway. I've also been working heavily with Julie over at PUD. At the PUD office, we've come into a major deficit there. Estimates are somewhere around 500,000 to 600,000. So I've been looking at ways to try to offset that deficit and what can we do. In addition, we still have the water that comes into the drinking system. That comes from the river, so we have to fight for the quantity of the river, the amount of water that comes to the river, because that's a part of what we utilize. But in addition on that, first year in, we were hit with green algae within the water system. Green algae actually works as a neurotoxin on the brain, and it does degrade the brain over time. There is no indication of exactly what the level which is acceptable, and at the time that we came into it, EPA had no standard or regulations on it, just said that it was hazardous. So over that course, that time period, and into this year, we were able to get funding for a treatment to go onto the water after it runs through the plant, and that's ozone treatment, which will pretty much kill the toxin. But there's just a multitude of other issues. We have the issues with the the water that is going out for irrigation and the cost and try and cover the overhead of that. We've had some significant water leaks that Julie has found over the past year, one of which she had said was losing roughly 250 gallons per minute. You multiply out 1 minute times 24 or you just multiply out 24 hours, 365 days, it's a tremendous amount of water. And so we've been going in and trying to repair that and get the cost of the water down for the residents, because right now we're looking at a tremendous bill on this, which has to get paid somewhere, whether that's going to be the people that are getting the benefit of the water or if it falls back on the tribe. We're still in those gray areas of trying to figure that out. But if we can get the cost down, then it may be something that we can really look at together and deal with and figure that one out. There's also the Tribal Cultural Resource Center. That was one of the things I came in with and wanted to see produced. Over this past year, we were able to get in an A&A grant, although we weren't successful at the initial A&A grant, which is one of the hardest grants to get out there. We were only about eight points away from getting to the point where we could have received it. And so what we're doing now is trying to get the A&A grant back in and clean up the little areas. It was small areas within that grant, like we didn't name the contractor that would be used. There was just some very minor details. So we're trying to get that back in to actually get that produced. In addition, we're looking at trying to do repatriation. Objects have gone all over the world, and how do we bring them back? And if we bring them back, where do they go? So that's another area that I've been involved in.
Okay. Well, yeah. Been a lot going on. Yeah, I understand the A&A grant process being first time I applied myself, so a lot of work. But well worth it, though. The representative of Mesquite Field and actually a person involved in environment, been involved in the EPA for a while, and actually your opponent has been involved in environmental issues too. So kind of, and you're both running for the same seat. So I kind of, oh, wow, this is quite a coincidence. Very good. There were some questions in the League of Women Voters. There were three questions that all involve climate change. And what the league did is they lumped them together. So I think they should be separate.
Okay.
So that's why I did that lead in about the environment. Okay. So how has climate change affected Hoopa Valley?
I think that we can see climate change affecting the entire global population. And then when you break it down just to Hoopa, you can look at the fight that's taking place over the water. You can see the changing in the environment as far as our gathering seasons over the past, maybe 15 years or better that I've noticed a change is that when you go out and gather beargrass, for instance, that timing has changed. And so it seems to be getting, some years it seems to be earlier, some years it seems to be later, but there's not a consistency. And then other things are not coming to full fruition when you're gathering for cultural purposes. So it has impacted us in ways that we may not completely realize yet, but it's here. We can see it in this summer that we're in now. The temperatures that we have, the fluctuations have been so up and down, random, and that's a part of climate change. We see the snowpacks. We're not getting the snowpacks that we got. That led into the water shortages that we've had. That's leading into this long-term drought that we're in. And that goes directly into the fight for the water that we're in. Because without the snowpacks coming in, people are still multiplying and needing more water, but we're not getting the water that is sustaining us over the course of the year. And so looking through at that venue, the Central Valley area is now pulling tremendous amounts of water, and they have been for a long time, but it's getting more of a fight for them to pull more water from our area to sustain their areas. And so that is tied into the climate change.
Okay, thank you. And well, following that, how should Hoopa Valley adjust to be more climate conscious?
gosh, these are some hard questions. Yeah. But, you know, these are hard questions that are being asked all around the country and around the world. I know that when I start working with climate change issues, oh gosh, this is going back probably about 2001 or 2002. I did bring climate change to the forefront for Region 9 EPA and got it on as one of our top priorities, because at that time we were starting to talk about it, but not really exploring. And also during that time period, we start seeing Alaska Native villages where the water was gaining a height that it was starting to take over their villages. And so they were looking at losing the village sites due to the water coming in. And that was a direct response to the climate change that was taking place. So as we come home to it, how can we change it? I think that it's such a big topic, such a big question, and we're such a small microcosm in that. But we really need to get more education out, and that's through the EPA department. There's a lot of research that was done on climate change and has continued to happen on climate change. But we need to get that outreach out to the general community of what actually is going on and how can we impact that? You know, our daily lives. Are there things that we can do in our daily lives that have an impact here that we're not even realizing? And so I think more education is how we can change that.
Yeah, that leads right into the third question that was
on
there.
Wow, I'm just on a roll here, aren't I?
On a roll, right there. Yeah, I'm just, how can we create a smaller carbon emissions footprint?
A smaller carbon emissions footprint? Well, I think that we actually have, as a global, a smaller carbon emissions footprint, but I think it's looking at ways that we can be better stewards of the land and better stewards of the resources that we have. I think that one of the areas that I've been advocating for since I've been on council and have been working with Kenny on this, and actually went through and reviewed past documentations that was done to create a recycle center. I know in my home, we compost, we recycle everything that we can. Metals, I'll haul out to the recycle center in Eureka because that's the one that will take a whole variety of metals. But even the simple things is composting. And we compost on a daily basis, as does your home, I believe. But looking at that as far as how can we save the resources or reuse the resources we have and recycle the resources. So through this venue, I've been looking years and years ago. Kenny had a staff member there, Curtis, who had done a whole section on the potential of a recycle center here within our community. But unfortunately, the tribe just has not moved on that. And so I've gone back to those documents, pulled them up, started looking with Kenny for any type of funding that may be there through environmental to do recycle centers. There, at one time when I was with the EPA, when I worked there, we had funding available for starting recycle centers or doing more recycle centers. Unfortunately, that funding has dried up. So continue to look for the funding. I think that what we came down to is that we could probably start one for as little as maybe $100,000 if we had a location to do it. There may be more money added in over the time depending on how much actually comes in, because the resource center should act like a small business that sustains itself. And when you look at the market for the recycled goods, it goes up and down like everything else does in the market. But what we'd have to cover is at least one employee to be there to start taking the stuff in and then start running the different pieces on out. And that would be a tremendous help, I believe, to helping with our carbon emissions here, our carbon footprint. Yeah. And then also there's housing. There's alternative styles for creating housing. I know that Leslie Hutt was creating a straw house this past year. And, you know, that's using your environment around you and utilizing what we have, natural materials. I know there's a straw house that's down on your side of the valley, almost across from where you live, and those are extremely good housing, cool in the summer and warm in the winter. It's very good, a good technique for construction. So looking at techniques for housing even.
Yeah, it's I was talking to one of the TIPA workers who started the latest metal drive and collecting all that. His report was they collected 390 tons of metal, and that's not including the refrigerators and the appliances. That was separate, just 390 tons of scrap metal.
And that's just the small stuff. And when Kenny and I had started talking about the whole project, I was actually pushing to try to get the trailers out here. I was like, man, if they're coming in to take metal out, let's get these scrap trailers out. You know, I think just about every portion of the valley has an old trailer that had burned down and has the remnants there, the metal remnants. And, you know, I know that that was very ambitious on my side, and Kenny was telling me it was very ambitious. They just simply didn't have the manpower and the resources necessary to do that type of cleanup, but it's still something I'm pushing for, because you look at the small components that come in, but look at the large stuff that's just laying out there, and all that could be picked up, and when you pick that up, it cleans up our community.
Okay, very good, thank you. Some other questions that were asked at the League of Women Voters session is, what's your position on the disposition, the disbursement, I guess it is, of the settlement funds that the Hoopoe Valley Tribe will receive?
What is my position on the
disbursement?
Okay, because you said disposition. I was like, you lost me there, sorry.
That confused me too, but that's what the...
Disbursement of funding. Well, I think that certainly there is some avenues for some of the funding. There is the funding that came through with the IHS, which I was on the negotiations for that, which we received $5.4 million. When that came down, what I had been told by IHS and others at that time was that it had to be used for the medical because it came through IHS. I've been told other things since that point, but I'm still kind of leaning on what IHS told me, which is that it needed to be used for medical. And so within that avenue, I was looking at the things that we could actually accomplish through that bit of money. 5.4 may seem like a lot, but when you look at the amount of membership, even if we per capped it all out, it wouldn't be that much. And then it may be taxable on you. It also may have ramifications for the member who may be receiving some sort of social benefit, where that would be cut off for a period of time, or they can get in trouble from whoever they're receiving their funding from, the state. And so what I was looking at with that was coming back with IHS, with the Kamel, and saying, hey, we know that when we go to the dental appointments, we're sitting for 3 months or 4 months trying to get in to see the dentist. We go in for maybe an hour visit, luckily if we're there longer, but they're trying to get us through because there's others waiting. So what I had talked to Kamel about early on was, can we get two more dentists? And then they said, well, there's a spacing issue. Okay, give us a budget for what you need to increase the size of that facility with the additional dentists. And then we talked about possibilities of prosthetic teeth. They said there's equipment out there, it'd be about $50,000 for the equipment. Then they would need to train someone to do some prosthetic teeth work. It all sounded good to us. Give us those budgets. We've also looked at the detox, because that's something that they've been looking for quite a while. And so now they're looking at a facility to possibly start working towards a detox center. There's a multitude that we need. And so the area that I get in, the question I get in is, do we just take the money and send it all out, and then we stay locked in the same situation that we are here? Or do we take a percentage of that and invest back into our community and invest into our membership, into us as a people? To me, I like to see investment into what we have, but I like to see sound investment. I don't like to see money just go out into an entity and get eaten up in t-shirts and salaries. I want to see a product out of it, and that's what I've been asking. What is the product that we're going to get? And give a good, sound plan to how we're going to get there and offer those resources that are needed in our community. You know, we can look all through the community and see many, many needs. We can look at all of the buildings that we have and the deterioration that is going on. The JOM building this past year, we had to close because it was unfit for human occupancy. It was deemed unfit. So we had to find someplace for that program to move into. You have the TANF program that had tremendous water leaks coming in over the wintertime, where they had garbage pails all through the offices with the water coming in over the electrical lines. We need to find ways to actually do the repairs necessary within the infrastructure, even in the facility that you're in here. I'm sure there's things that we need to do. This building is 45 years old or older, but we haven't done a tremendous amount of repairs or infrastructure work, so we need to figure that component out. When we look at the RAMA money coming in, which is a completely different pot of money, we think it's somewhere just over $8 million, but we're not 100% sure, at least I'm not 100% sure as to an exact dollar amount yet. We have heard that that will come in three payments, somewhere towards the end of the year when that comes in. So that one, it's my understanding we're a little bit freer with. But even looking at that one, if we take the 8 point whatever million that comes in, and let's say we per cap it all out, that per cap check then will bounce to the neighboring communities and it'll be gone. And even at that, you're looking at maybe $1,500, which would then be taxable from what I understand. And then again, if you're on a social service program, you could be nailed on receiving that money from the tribe because of the nature of the settlement that's come in. What I'd like to see is for some money to go out. I think that there needs to be money going out, but we need to generate money from our businesses to put out to the membership. And we should also look at what is our main needs within our community. You know, I live here in the community. I was shopping here until the day that the store closed. I'm a part of this community, and there's tremendous needs I see all over. So how can we fix those needs when grant funding is not available? Well, there is no funding out there that we've been able to find to go in and repair all the infrastructure that we need here, the buildings that have been here for like 40 years, because we own it. So there becomes our responsibility. So that's kind of how I'm looking at it. My ears are always open, though, and I'm always taking in more information. And the more information I get, the better the decision, I think. But I think that we really need to look at ourselves and our community. What do we need here?
Okay, thank you. Continuing on with some of the other questions that were presented there. We have several at-risk youth in our community. What is your plan to address the issue?
The at-risk youth, and actually, Joe, that was what I was saying, that I was actually meeting with someone talking about programs out there for at-risk. We have programs in place here, but I don't think that they're really reaching the full potential. I know that over the past couple of years, we've had discussions with Humboldt County and looking at their advocacy. I was with Changing Tides the other day, which is a nonprofit in Eureka that has a lot of funding that comes through them that fund a lot of different things for youth advocacy, at-risk youth. It's a multitude. And so what I was looking at with them is, what are the different types of programs that you have? Looking at county, because you have Stephanie, who is I believe she's Yurok tribal member, who's the head of the social service there. What programs do they have? How can those programs work together? And really looking at our community and what types of things do we need and how can we get the support from you? You know, it may not just be a financial dollar coming into the community for us to do whatever. They offer resources, a tremendous amount of resources. What's been coming in from both of them is a lack of location. And so what I've been talking about with them and with others is trying to figure out location. What is the mechanism just to get location? Because if we can get locations for services, then that opens the door to a lot of opportunities for us. How can that be structured? And so these have been the conversations I've been having with them. And trying to figure this component out. And then how do we interlock and interwork the programs that we currently have with all of the programs that are there that may or may not be completely functioning here? I think there's a lot of possibilities within that, but we have to step back and really look at how can this be done and form a good plan working with them to do this. If we just fly by the hip and try to do something, things don't seem to work that way. So I'm trying to figure out all the programs there, how we can work. There's another area that I've been concerned with and one that I guess you can say I'm a bit passionate about because of my own frustrations I've seen over the course of time, which is that when we have child placement through our court system, that child and that family may not receive the benefits as a child if they went through county for placement. So what I'm talking about there is a child that goes through the county process for placement, the family that has the child come into their home receives a check from the county for, I think it's $800 a month. And then that child also qualifies for education, full ride scholarships, up to the age, I think, of 22 or so. But there's a multitude of benefits that child then qualifies for by going through county, because that's county and state funding. We don't have that when we go through the tribal court system, and they look at us differently because we're tribal. And so the other question I've been posing to the people I've been chatting with on the child advocacy stuff is, what process can we go through, or what do we need to do to strengthen our tribal court, in that if there is a child that is placed through our tribal court, that child and those families would receive all the same benefits? And what do we need to do to get to that point? Is it a matter of an agreement with us? Is there some certification? What is it? And that's the area I've been hitting a brick wall and finding answers, because there doesn't seem to be many answers out there of how to get that. But I see that as a tremendous problem, because we have a lot of children here today that are falling into the categories of going to live with their grandparents or their great-grandparents. And my mom had her granddaughter, great-granddaughter, for nearly 6 to 8 years. Vast majority of the time, there was no funding that came in to help support. We just did it. She's now moved on to another foster home, but she went through foster care finally through Humboldt County. And so there is a benefit that comes to her in the long run. But Yurok Tribe has been extremely active in working to support her as well. And so all the meetings that we've had, they've been there. Last night after I got home, I think it was like after the meeting was like darn near 10 o'clock when I got home, I had gotten a phone call from an individual asking specifically about ICWA questions. So there are a number of things that we need to do in our community and trying to find those services. So I've been active on that. That was a lengthy answer. Sorry.
That's fine. That's fine. We don't have that 2-minute limit that the League of Women Voters has, but yeah, it gives you time to express yourself. Thank you. Well, I think that public safety is also an issue with children, and so I was just thinking about. You're going to say something.
Yeah, on the public safety issue with children, or even just people in general walking on the side of the road, it's been a pet peeve of mine for years. I have a bike. I actually enjoy riding a bicycle. But there's no riding paths here. So to ride from my home down the valley up here to the grocery store, it could be dangerous. Going around the Bluffy area, there's no bike paths. There's no walking paths. But yet you see the tremendous amount of people that would walk up to the downtown area from both sides. Last year, somewhere between last year and the year before, council came together and we pushed for lighting. And so we worked through our areas from council level and was able to get the downtown lighting going just to try and make it safe for people walking around here. We're supposed to be doing some sidewalk projects, and I've been waiting and asking and waiting and asking. That was supposed to come in from the side down by Ollie Mae's house over past Shoemaker. There was supposed to be a sidewalk start there and running partially through town. There's the downtown project here was supposed to include sidewalks, and with the stuff that they put in downtown, although I may not really like the design of it, I'm still having issues with it. I think I ran over the curb a couple times now. What they said was that was helping to provide some walking paths for the pedestrians too. And they're supposed to be trying to do walking paths down to the other end of the valley. I'm still waiting on that and pushing on it. So public safety is there.
Yeah, well, you just covered that other question. I was going to ask, what was your opinion about the work that they have done, Caltrans has done in downtown area? Because the one letter I saw or notice I saw in the newspaper that the Caltrans was coming in and are going to do this downtown area, and then the tribe was supposed to pick up the maintenance of that. And there's supposed to be trees in there. But you look in those little planters, and it's blacktop. You can't grow anything in there.
There's nothing in there. There was no spigots put in there for water, no sprinkling systems, anything. When that project was getting ready to start, or had just started, there was a multitude of meetings that we had with the department. And through the meetings, I had asked them specifically to put a board out here in front of the store and get the notifications out to your people here. This is a community. It's more than a membership. It's a community. We all live here. So get the idea out that you're doing. Show a picture of what it's going to be. When we go to any other urban area, there's usually a big board up on the vacant lot or wherever the work's going to take place, depicting what's going to take place there.
Coming soon.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I was pushing for over here, but it just didn't seem to happen. And, you know, these are some of the frustrations I've gone through over the years, pushing for stuff. But, you know, we're kind of one-man show over on our side at times, it feels, because we don't have the staff necessary to push through. So if we take on a multitude of issues, then we're stretched so thin trying to make sure that those things are taking place or getting back in touch with whatever. So it becomes difficult. But as a council person, it is a difficult road to hoe. Trying to do a lot, and it's just you at times out there because we don't have the admin staff. And I think all councilors are feeling that at this point. I've heard from other council members that are trying to get stuff going that we really could use the help because we're stuck in meetings with stuff virtually all day and then trying to work on the projects that we're trying to work on the sides.
What kind of help are you talking about? What do you need?
Well, what we've been talking about is just admin assistance help, stuff for if we're looking for information. For instance, one of the things I've been working on and brought to the forefront at the national level was with trying to compact EPA fundings. If we can compact the EPA fundings, then we can use those how we see best fit, not how somebody behind a desk in an agency tells us we have to use them. But in order to do this, where I could use the help is asking someone to do some research. What other tribes have gone down this route, and where did they make it to? Get a copy of what that is. I've heard of two or three tribes that have tried. They've not been successful yet, but they've done it as an individual. I'm trying to do it through the self-governance, so it's a larger body. But start pulling those documentation things together. Working on this whole idea of trying to do a recycle center to have somebody that could help pull the information, because when I go home at night, I'm on my phone online trying to pull what other tribes have done, looking for grant stuff. It's a multitude. So just those individuals that can help us as we're moving along, because we're stuck in meetings the whole day. And then at night is when we start trying to look for whatever it is that we're trying to look for or figure out.
Okay. I'm talking with Bradley Marshall, the incumbent for the Muscat Field District Tribal Council, and he's campaigning for his reelection, and it's about 11:37. I'll try to go to the top of the hour here and continue on. I'm just giving you a chance to take
live.
A drink of water. Yeah, we're live. And so we'll take a... we'll continue on some other questions. We're talking about safety, and one of the issues, I live on a highway, Mesquite Field. Okay. It's a straightaway. Mesquite Field must have about the longest straightaway in the valley. Maybe Campbell Field does too. But anyway, it looks like it's wide open because there's the way that the housing is situated, but all of the driveways are right on the highway. And so you don't know when somebody's coming out, or if they're in a hurry or something like that. And then there's a lot of area to pass somebody if they're going too slow or slower than you want them to go. And I'm just waiting for, don't want it to happen, but sometimes somebody's going to get run over, or somebody's going to be colliding out there, and they just go too fast. How can we slow traffic down on that portion of the highway?
Well, the highway itself is a little bit different for us because the highway is through Caltrans. Caltrans maintains that whole span. There are some some side roads too. Apparently Caltrans watches Marshall Lane behind you. I know that there's been issues over there where the signs have been run over, the signs have been knocked down, the stop signs, all sorts of things over there, and not put up. I know that there was a request came in quite a while back for doing speed bumps just on Marshall Lane and back, because, if, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was a couple accidents back there already over the course of the last few years. And so I did take that back over to our department that deals with that and asked about that, and they said, well, that's Caltrans' responsibility. And so I tried leaning in on it, but again, it was very little traction to get anything moving. I think that we should be able to do some stuff in there, but then we have to rely back onto our roads department to really do that stuff. I know that council has, over the course of time, asked for a lot of different things from the roads department to produce for us. And then we go into a waiting scene, and then we go into funding issues. You know, there's a multitude that we have to try to work with. But to your specific question on that spanse of road, that's Caltrans' responsibility. And so even when they were doing the new blacktop down there a few years back, you remember that? One thing I went to our department with and said, hey, how come they're not putting in the pedestrian lane? Every other area I've been in, when I see them going through with blacktop, they're doing the bike lane, pedestrian lane. You know, they have those lanes in there. Why are they not doing it here? The road's wide enough. Put it in. And what I was told was that, well, we're going to be doing that. And to me, it was confusing. This was before I was on council, of why are we going to do that when they do that every place else? You know, so sometimes I think that we could move forward with projects that they're doing and put things in there to get those benefits. Instead of saying, we're going to do it ourselves, have them do it when they're doing these. So if they're blacktopping down there, put those biking lanes in, and we need to lean on them for that.
One of those signs that they have was speed limits, your speed type of thing. That would be helpful, I think.
That would be, and you know, that's something that I could probably work on actually through the Humboldt County law enforcement or something along that line. I think that they're the ones that provide those. I do sit in periodically with the Humboldt County Roundtable, which is the law enforcement stuff. And so I can bring that up at that meeting to try to get some signs down there. But I think the other thing is just having more law enforcement. I know that coming over here today, I've seen Humboldt County pulling someone over. I think it's good that we have them here. I'd like to see other things happen, but at least we have some sort of a presence, and we're trying to build our law enforcement back as well. So I think once you start seeing more officers around, you'll start seeing people slow down as well.
Yeah. Most likely happens, yeah. In your opinion, what will be the effects of the passing of the ballot measure to amend Title 34?
The marijuana one?
The suspension of cultivation. That's what Title 34 is.
I have a couple of different thoughts on that one. One is that we went through the ballot measure last year, and the people had spoken. This one came on because of the individuals that had gotten enough signatures. If you have enough signatures, you can get anything put on the ballot, and that's what happened. I also look at what's currently going on within the state of California and the push for legalization. I think that, you know, we're coming into an area now where it may be kind of like Colorado, put in for recreational use. Yet under federal guidelines, it's a Schedule I. And so these are some areas of that aren't working together. If the state says, hey, it's fine for everyone else around, but federal says it's not for you, then why is it not? Am I a happy camper with the whole thing? Not really. But, you know, my decision, or my personal opinion has to be removed out of it. Last year when I took a stance against legalization of it within our community, it was because at that point when I was asking questions at the funding sources, when I asked Washburn, who was the head of BIA, what are you guys going to do to tribes that do this? And he gave me this whole wash on how it's a height of sovereignty. I'm like, yeah, we can do this stuff. I got that. But what are you going to do to our funding sources? And all he would say is, Brad, it's a Schedule I narcotic. You know, and so that left me in another gray area of what are you going to do? What is the funding agency going to do? And what I seen this past year was it Redding Rancheria, I think it was? They got busted over there. There was a couple other tribes that were doing operations that had everything seized. That was just last year. This year, I don't know what's coming. You know, I know that there's legislation that's coming down, supposedly, that are going to be changing some of that stuff. So I don't know. I think that is actually a question for the membership. What do you guys want? What do you want, Joe? What does the member want out there? Because it is on the ballot. So now this is your opportunity to say what you want, to formulate what it is. Either you vote yes or no, but it's ultimately now in the laps of the people and not in the council to make the determination.
Okay. Thank you. That's good. Come back. I like that. Moving on here then. There's another question that was asked at the sessions. What's your position on the Hoopoe Valley Tribe support of education?
Education, I've supported that from way back. Gone through the college system here, attended CR here in Hoopoe, went on, got my degree at Humboldt State. My degree's Native American Studies with an emphasis on federal Indian law. Taught classes at Humboldt when I was attending Humboldt. My mom was working in the school for 20 plus years. I got family that work in the school. I've been a strong advocate for it. With our past education director, I was always there at anything that she needed. The last thing I had done with her was attending meetings in D.C. looking at trying to find funding to bring in to offset the black mold issue that we have, the funding that we get in the school, trying to figure out that component to how much is coming into the school here through the federal agencies, and then looking at our test scores as being so low. Why are they so low? And you have this money coming in. So we start really diving into that stuff. In addition, I was in congressional subcommittee hearings with her. This was 2 months ago now or 3 months ago now. Some of my time runs together. And at those meetings, what we were doing was lobbying Congress for additional funding to come into the Indian Education Program, which is the funding that comes directly into us, as well as the rest of the country. So we did pull parts of Hoopoe out to emphasize the direct need for the funding, but we were looking at the larger pot as well, because we're all related. You know, my cousin was a past chair for the Otham Tribe, Arizona. My nephew is on the Iroquois. My aunt is on Crookle. You know, we're related all over. So what we were doing was looking at, and we were invited by the main organization to come in to be a part of this dialogue, was trying to increase funding through Congress and getting those congressional appropriations of funding for tribal schools and tribal entities that are dealing with education. I think that we received really well. There was three other tribes, I think, that were present there, and they gave their stories. Some were really good. Some were looking for more. We were kind of in the middle of it, looking at, hey, we have this going on, but we want to do a lot more. And so I think there is a lot that we can do, and I'm eager for us to continue doing stuff. We're the first tribe that, in my understanding, that had a branch campus, a college campus, open on a reservation in California. And the tribe did that. So we've been at the forefront for education for many, many years. I think that all we can do is get stronger, but we also have to lobby for those dollars to come in. Right now, the tribe bears a lot of the brunt for paying the scholarships. And so every time they come in the budget, we're trying to figure out, where we can take money from to actually put in the scholarship funding. But I'm asking, why aren't we getting more from the federal government? And the reason we're not is we're not there advocating for those appropriations funding to come down into the overall bills, which then translates out to us.
Okay. A follow-up question on that then would be, what career or earning opportunities can be created that better uses the creative skills of our local female workforce?
Female workforce, so going specific. I think there's a number of areas, but I would like to start general on that question. I know that there are people that are interested in trade schools, and one of the areas that has been interesting is how do we fund people wanting to go to trade schools? Normally what we do is a JC level or a certified university. There's nothing in writing for us saying that we can't fund trade schools if someone wants to go off to a trade school. This past week, the tribe put $50,000 into a budget, so we robbed from Peter to pay Paul to put money into a budget, but that budget's up to $50,000 to help pay for trade school for individuals. We had one individual that has gone through, and is going to be receiving that funding, but we still have the money left in there. And what we said was pretty much that we'll use it until it's gone. So it's first come, first serve this year, but next year we're going to try to put the trade schools within the budget, try to put something in there. But going back to the rent documentation on it, we never said that we wouldn't. It's just kind of been a practice we've done without the documentation saying that we're not supportive of it. And so I think that we just need to go back to what was put in place with our education program to see, hey, if it is actually written there, then we need to change that verbiage in that to include it. If it's not, then we just need to strengthen us being able to offer those. Because the four-year university, it's not for everybody. I was early 30s when I finally graduated. Even JC level, it may not be for everybody. Maybe someone wants to go off to cabinet school. Maybe someone wants to go to lineman school or something. I don't know. But to make those opportunities available. Now, to the specific question of female, in my mind, I don't differentiate between male and female for career choices. I think that female workforce is tremendous here. I think that if you go to our medical, you'll see more females working within the medical than you see males. If you go to education, you'll see more females working there than males. So I don't see a differentiation in that. I think that we have to be able to give full opportunity to the individual all the way through. And that means if they're going on to a higher education, then we need to find ways to fund their master programs as well, or their PhD programs. Take the people as far as they can to succeed at whatever it is they want, because I think we're truly in a time that the world is your oyster. You just have to reach out for it.
And, well, what I've noticed in the areas and tribal, economic development, a lot of the projects that we do are more male-oriented. And that's what brought up the question as well. We like the roads things, that the females are the ones holding the signs.
But you got to remember,
I'm just saying that's not the best use of the creative ability of a person.
I get what you're saying, but within that one too, because I had that question early on, and what I was told was that is actually a women-owned business, a female-owned business, minority-owned business, who puts out for hiring specifically females and then contracts directly to Caltrans as a meebie weebie. So that's why you see all of them all over here with female workers. And so my understanding is that it is headed by a female.
Well, that's good news.
And so, you know, again, this goes into part of that workforce. So, you know, what we see on the surface may not be completely what's the underlying. So I think it's really great that this individual, female individual, created her own business structure in a niche that no one else was doing, and then was able to qualify under the Maybe Weebies, which is a minority-owned, women-owned businesses, to come up at a higher level to get those contracts and hiring women to do that. So to me, that is just like the perfect scenario of someone doing great things.
Creativity. Very good. Thank you. Now I know. So what is your position on the Hoopoe Valley Tribe's law enforcement agreement, and do you support the retrocession of the public law 280?
So the, oh gosh, which one do you start with? The retrocession of 280, that has been going on for a multitude of years. It's been maybe four chairmen back or better is when it started. I'm not sure exactly the specific date. I think it might have been early on with Leonard, or it may have even been before Leonard's time. So you're about three or four chairs back. And it's been pundit around. To my knowledge, there's one tribe that was able to retrocede from it. But once they retrocede it, then that meant that the federal government picks up everything. And so everyone's been kind of punted around with that has gone in for the retrocession. Will it happen? Maybe someday. But there's things that you have to be aware of within that if we go down that path, which is when you retrocede, that means that we pull away from the state and county for stuff. And we're going to be self-sufficient. Couldn't say that word for some reason. Just didn't want to come out. where's our jail cells here? So if we arrest someone, where's our holding cells? Because we're federal, does that mean that we'd have to transport to San Francisco and try to go through the San Francisco court system for cases, which San Francisco, which is Ninth Circuit, would not hear the stuff. They only do the high-profile cases. So how do we do this? How do we maintain a jail cell? It's a lot more complicated than just throwing up a brick building and putting bars on it. At this point, you have to offer medical around the clock for the inmate. You have to offer the three meals. There's entertainment. There's a multitude of stuff. You have to have staff there. So how are we going to be able to afford this? Where is it coming from? And I think that's part of the reason that the federal government has just kind of pushed everything off to the side, and they keep saying, we're getting back to you, we're getting back to you, but they don't give a yes or no. Because I think that how do you answer the question for the amount of money that's obligated at that point? And then you get into our own law enforcement. We've appropriated a lot of money for the law enforcement, but we seem to have difficulties hiring. And that runs for numerous reasons. Right now, the county is short on staff themselves for law enforcement. And when you look at the amount of money that the tribe can offer to someone coming out, we don't have the PERS agreement. That's their retirement and everything else that they qualify for. Their salary starts out higher than us. If they get hurt on the job, they have their salary all the way through their lives. There's a multitude of stuff that comes through the PERS agreement, their retirements and everything, that we can't compete with. And so as an individual coming through, whether you're tribal member or non-tribal member, if you're coming through this and you're looking at the job and your career that you're going to be at for your life, if one offers more, where are you going to go? And I think that's what we're in with the law enforcement, is trying to be competitive. And we've seen Humboldt County take some of our officers that we had here. You know, we've seen, I think, two officers leave thus far to county, if not more. And that's just because the stuff that was being offered. And so it's hard for us to compete, but we're still trying. And we're trying to build that law enforcement. I think that we have a lot going for us, but we have a lot to do. And we are working on it diligently. I think that the interim chief of police has been very active on trying to locate officers, trying to do stuff, trying to better the community. And I know that the students that went through the program that the tribe paid for, they're doing the best they can do to help support the community and do what they can do for the community. And then the other question was on, that was retrocession.
Yes. That's when you started out with.
Right. Okay. So I answered both of you there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I thought I might have, but I wasn't sure.
Okay. Let's do one more question, then we'll give you some time to close.
Okay.
Okay. So talking about jobs, what do you see as an economic development? How do we do what jobs do you see that we need in order to achieve economic development in our community?
Well, I think it goes a little bit deeper than just jobs. I think that when you look at our community, this year's tribal budget was set at $67 million. Last year, we were at $78 million. The year before, we were at $89 million or something like that. That is a lot of money that comes into our community and then just goes out to the neighboring community, Eureka. You know, when we're talking per capita, we had that $40 million that came in, and Eureka's seen a huge spike in their economy. That $40 million went from here and went to Eureka. What are we doing to keep the money here? We got to really push for local businesses. We got to lean on our loans department over there. When I was chatting with loans the other day about how many tribal members actually have loans through you versus the tribal entity, what I was told was there are no tribal members with current loans. It's the entities that are doing the loans. Well, to me, there's an issue. Why are we not going there for loans? Why are we not going there for creating small business? A pet peeve of mine for years has been Murdy's store, the little Office FX down here. That was your perfect maybe weeby. That was a native-owned, women-owned, small business. And then you look at the tribe, how much goes out just in buying paper and office stuff. But yet her store was getting less than 1% of our business. So it's actually having to reshape our own mindset of putting our money into our community. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side, but what's that do to our own yard? We have to start looking at the grants that come in, say, okay, we're going to do a stream restoration project through whatever entity. Well, let's not run out to another community to hire people to come in as an entity to work for us. Let's look at development of those positions here. Let's try to get it into a small business that is created where it can go out to contract to that small business. But then we also have to look at the taro tax that's associated. Should we be charging small businesses, startup business, a taro tax because they're Indian? Are we actually hurting ourselves? We got a lot that we have to look at, but we have a structure already put in place, which is saying that we are going to buy local. We're going to buy here, but we don't follow that. And then we just completed the SEDS plan, which is really trying to steer how we're going to be doing local development for businesses, for jobs, all of that stuff. Now we have to take it back one more step and re-look at the overall goals and objectives of the tribe and interlace that those two plans together so that we're moving on the same path.
Okay. Well, all right. You're listening to KIDE Hoopah and interviewing Bradley Marshall, who's asking for your support to reelect him in the next term. And it's give you a few moments here to do a closing statement as we're at the top of the hour, a little bit past it, and almost an hour into this program.
A closing statement?
Yeah.
Okay.
The floor is yours.
The floor is mine. Well, I probably should have started with this, but for those of you who may not know me, my name is Vernon Bradley Marshall. My father was Vernon Marshall. Everyone knew him as Snooks. Lived here virtually all of his life, except when he was off in the military. My mom is Irma Marshall. She's been here, I think she moved here when she was 7 years old or 9 years old, something like that. So she's been here virtually all of her life, too. I left for a number of years for school and because I had to work. I worked in environmental field from, early 90s, from US EPA and then into the tribes. The education portion that we had talked about, I was a liaison at UC Berkeley, so I've done a lot of stuff through the university system as well, taught classes at Humboldt. I've done a lot of stuff in my life, and this was coming home for me. You know, I made the decision to come home. I tendered my resignation at Berkeley a few years back to come home. And when I came home, I was looking at my mom was getting older. She needed someone to help her. Since I've been home, my mom has had three major falls and taken her to the hospital emergency, sat there all through the night waiting for her to get in. But it's just part of becoming an elder and what I consider our traditional life ways, taking care of your family, taking care of your elders. So that's my parents. My grandparents was Ernie Marshall, who was on council. He was the representative of Musket Field for numerous times. He was the chair for several times. That's when back when Elsie Griffiths was on council and we were really moving forward with stuff. And my grandmother was Florence Harry. And my grandparents on the other side were from Karuk and Arizona, southern Arizona. But for me, it was a choice to come home. To leave Berkeley, yeah, I left a really good job, one that had tremendous benefits, one that had a lot of stuff going, but it was a drive to come home. And coming home, seeing so many things that I want here for us as a community, us as tribal members, that's my drive to be a part of this, to do stuff here. How can we build? What is it that we need? And how do we construct this where it's going to last us not 1 year, but 50, 60 years, you know, changing our lives. Looking at the rehab center, even with that, if it can change one person's life, one tribal member's life, didn't we do good with that? And so it's looking at how can we build, how can we create and make lives better.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time and wish you luck in your reelection. And we have been talking with Bradley Marshall, the incumbent for the Musket Field seat on the Hoopoe Valley Tribal Council. The election date is Tuesday, June the 28th. Polls open at 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. We have an open invitation for your opponent here, Vivina Orchid, who, we'll open up for Monday because she should have 7 days, but we don't have 7 days. So we'll squeeze her in on Monday if that's possible, and that's her choice. So,
well, one more thing, sure. Joe. My mind's always working. Is I'm glad that she's in the race. I'm really glad that she chose to step out to run because it does take a lot for our membership to step out to try to do those lead roles within our community. I would like to see in the future more and more young people come out and run for council because I think that's going to really change the dynamics of our people is through the youth. So every election, I encourage younger people, put your name in, run. It doesn't matter how old you are, you can do it.
Well, thank you for that. And we would agree. Yeah, we need more younger people in our offices. Just need fresh ideas coming from that young understanding. And we need some old guys too, and women, and because there's comes with it wisdom, experience too. So it's a mix. With that, we'll bring this tribal campaign 2016 to a close. This is Joseph Orozco reporting for KIDE, and we'll return to our regular scheduled program in progress. Thank you very much for listening.
How was that?
Pretty good. I thought it was pretty good. Yeah.
Some of those questions are hard.